Okay, so our speaker today is Daniele Francetti, who speaks about CFT degrees of freedom from LQG boundary excitations. Daniele. Daniele, are you ready? Daniele, are you ready to start?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so if everybody can hear me, I start. I'm going to talk about the appearance of new CFT degrees of freedom on the boundary when we have LQG excitations. This work is done in collaboration with Laurent Friedel and Leandro Perez, and hopefully will appear online very soon. So now if we go to slide 2, I will give a brief introduction of what we are doing. So basically in loop quantum gravity, the description of geometry has been so far mainly focused on the bad degrees of freedom, in particular when it comes to the dynamics. So we could wonder, like, what about the boundary? And what about the dynamics of the boundary? And what about the quantum geometry degrees of freedom at the boundary? And also, what about matter, which somehow we don't talk about too much? And then we can ask ourselves if we may need a new symmetry principle to investigate those two aspects. And we can ask if there is a way within the LQG framework to implement a notion of bulk boundary correspondence, which could allow to include matter degrees of freedom, and which might provide a simplified description of the bulk dynamics, in particular and across grain level. So let's go to slide 3. Now, if we can answer this question from the case, then that we could borrow and implement techniques and ideas which have been developed already in other fields where this bulk boundary correspondence is used heavily. And we could investigate somehow a simpler approach, maybe to the continuum limit and the semi-classical limit of the theory. Moreover, the introduction of new mathematical structure could provide some unexpected and deep physical insights. So what we're going to do in the rest of the talk is to try to move some steps in this direction. So let's go to slide 4. I'm going to give you a summary of the talk. In loop quantum gravity, geometry is fundamentally discrete. And we expect smooth geometry to a large scale to emerge as a consequence of some coarse graining of these fundamentally discrete Planckian degrees of freedom. Now, motivated by this fundamental discreteness, we show that there is a new type of degrees of freedom, such as CFT degrees of freedom, which are naturally present if we consider the canonical structure of GR on a 3D slice, which has a 2D boundary punctured by spin natural links. So these new degrees of freedom will live around the punctures on this 2D boundary. And this new degrees of freedom, which somehow I'll argue have to be introduced to this, restore this invariance of the boundary, have a representation in terms of free massless fields. And moreover, they satisfy an holographic bound. So this is the summary of the talk. Now we can start in slide number 5. Let me point out that there were previous results which led to the ideas that converge into this work. And apart from the authors, there are other papers which somehow have been influential for us. There is a paper by Laurent Krasnov-Levin where some intriguing but at the same time mysterious results appeared concerning the holographic property of quantum tetrahedron, and we believe that with this analysis we can understand better what the nature of these results. Moreover, I have to point out that several ideas that we use in this analysis somehow were already applied in this original work by Lee on the Chersamen's description of boundary degrees of freedom. More recently, there has been some application of CFT in the context of low quantum gravity. In particular, there's been a work by Langrick and Speziale where they studied the conformal transformation applied to twisted geometries. And also, there's been a proposal by Campia, Gambini, and Pullin of an application of LQG techniques to conforming by extension of GR coupled to the standard model. Okay, so let's go to slide number 6. And so we start with the formulation of gravity on a manifold, which has the topology of M cross R, where M represents a three-dimensional space-like upper surface. And this upper surface has a boundary, which is a 2-sphere. Now, so the boundary has the topology of F2 cross R, which I think I have written here, but I will denote like capital delta in the rest of the talk. And so we start with an action formulation of vacuum gravity, which includes this boundary term. So we write down the action 1. And the back term is basically just the Hall's action. While the second term is a boundary term that we add, let me first define what are the variables that enter here. So A, IJ is it's not a proper connection, but we call it boundary connection quotation mark, but it's an object which is formed out of two connections, the Lorentz spin connection and its dual, in gamma is the Barberi-Mitchell parameter. And then we, on the boundary, we also have a frame field EI. Now, in the back, the flux is defined by the simplicity constraint. That's why this is the whole action for the back. And this boundary action, basically, it's easy to see that it's simply given by the integral on the boundary of two densities. The first one is the well-known Gibbons-Hawking-York boundary density, which is given by the extrinsic curvature, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and H denotes the determinant of the induced magic on the boundary. And the second one is the integral over free form that basically is just EI wedged the omega EI. And notice that this is like similar to what one does with the Hall's term in the back. This is an additional boundary term which vanishes on shell due to the torsion precondition. So this is the action that we start with. Now, let's go to slide 7. And since basically we eventually want to do an Hamiltonian treatment and use the Hashtag of Barberio connection formulation, we need to appeal to some extra structure that allows us to introduce such variables. This is the time gauge, which is naturally provided by the necessary 3+1 decomposition of the Hamiltonian formulation. So we have a foliation of space-time in terms of a spatial surface M. And we choose E0, the E0 component of the tetras, to be given by the normal to this space-like surface. So E0 is equal to M normal. And then we can show that via the standard covariance space procedure, the symplectic form is given by two terms. There is a bulk term, which is the standard symplectic form that we use in the quantum gravity. But there is also a boundary symplectic form, which is given in terms of these triad variables on the boundary. Now, from this, we can read immediately the Poisson brackets, which are the standard Poisson brackets that we have in the bulk, and there is this boundary phase space where the triad becomes non-commutative on the boundary. Now, if we do a variation with respect to the connection, this gives us the first boundary constraint, which is it's the first term in equation 3, which is basically Gauss' law. And it's a boundary condition that identifies the bulk flux with its boundary counterpart. And this corresponds to the simplicity constraint at the boundary. So this generates a gauge transformation on the boundary. Now, we have to be a bit more careful when we vary the coframe. And here we use the fact that we have fixed foliation. So we demand on the boundary the condition that the variation of E0 on the boundary is 0. So we don't vary 0 at the boundary. And with this boundary condition, then we get the second boundary constraint, which is this dA of EI equals 0. So this is a fundamental equation that we will use in the follow, and it's a sort of generalized statistical constraint, which imposes somehow the non-rotation of the boundary with respect to its slice. So this is basically a condition, there is a Cartan first structure equation, and there is a condition on the embedding, on the extrinsic curvature of a boundary. And it can be fulfilled in a, it's a general condition, can be fulfilled in a several settings. In particular, it can be fulfilled in the case of a stretch horizon for a spatial black hole, and also in other examples. So these are the boundary conditions that we get from this action. Now, we can move to slide number 8. And the goal of our analysis is to study the quantization of this boundary system in the presence of the ground field. So in order to understand this point, it's important to appreciate the fact that the pullback of the flux sigma on S on the two sphere of the boundary and the components of the connection which are tangential to the boundary, they commute with each other. This allows us basically to fix them to any value on the boundary and study the boundary in the space when in presence of these boundary fields. So we can introduce these background fields, Ji and Ki, which parameterize the background geometry and the background curvature of, on the boundary. This is written in equation 1. Now, motivated by quantum gravity, we assume that on the sphere, so we have n punctures which arrive on the sphere, like you can picture, it's pictured in on the image on the top right. And we can decompose the two sphere as a union on infinitesimal disks, which surround the puncture, and the complement of which is the rest of the two sphere in between these disks. So we can choose then any general surface element on this two sphere, which are called S, which could be either the complement or the disk, and then we can look for the generators of the gauge and the tangent distal transformations. And by imposing that in Hamiltonian evolution, we get this two expression for the Gauss generator, sigma S of alpha, and for the tangent diffeo generator, ds of dv is the vector field tangent to the horizon. Now, basically, by construction, sigma on the complement is equal to zero, where we are away from the punctures, and the sigma around the puncture is the one that generates the gauge rotation of the puncture. Now, at this point, we introduce some charges, which we call Kac-Moody charges for a reason that will be clear soon. And this I give in equation 2. This generates also on gauge transformation, which are written below equation 2. And it can be shown that we can rewrite the tangent different generators in terms of these charges for a specific choice of this parameter phi. And this, in particular, can by imposing the statistical constraint that I showed before, this allows us to rewrite the different generators only as a circle integral, so only as a quantity that lives on the circle. And so this is going to play an important role in the following. So is there any question at this point? Do you hear me well?
Yes, we hear you well.
Okay. So if there are no questions, we can move to slide 9. So here I justify the name for these charges. In particular, if you compute the Poisson bracket of these charges using the synthetic structure for the boundary, we get this, the first equation, which where KIP, if you remember, is this background field which parameterizes the curvature of, on the two sphere. And then there is this circle term. And then if we solve the condition that the curvature is localized around the puncture, in the neighborhood of the puncture by using gauge fixing, then it can be shown that this boson bracket takes the form 1. And this is that these are three copies of U1 Kakubodi algebra with a central extension which is given by 1 over 4 times the Barberini-Mitte parameter. So we can then do a decomposition in modes of these charges. When we introduce this angle theta, this is the angle that goes around the puncture on the circle. And we can rewrite the Poisson bracket 1 in terms of mode. This is maybe might be more familiar for some of the things like the algebra before gives the algebra 2 for the modes of the charges. So what we see is that there is a Kakumudi algebra structure which follows directly just from the gravitational sympathy structure when we have some distributional configurations for these punctures on the boundary. And also notice that those charges in the complement of the two spheres away from the circle, such that the phis vanishes on the circle, they form a first-class algebra, the commutator. The Poisson bracket vanishes. And in a moment, we will construct the reduced phase space, which obtained by imposing that this first class constraint can be mod out by gauge transformation they generate. And this will play an important role to make a clear connection with the CFT. So before doing that, though, let's move to slide 10. And build the VSO generators. This can be done in a standard way using the Sugawara construction. So in equation 1, this is the Sugawara construction where this semicolons indicate the normal ordering, which is given on the right-hand side of equation 1. And if we now use the commutators that we found before for the Kakumodi modes, we can compute the algebra of these Virasoro modes. At this gives equation 2, which is a Virasoro algebra, with a central charge at C equals 3, which this comes from the fact that we have 3 U1 copies of Kakumodi algebra, which again follows directly just from the gravitational sympathy structure in the presence of punctures. So we find this Virasoro algebra. Now, let's go to slide number 11, and this is where the sketch things I was mentioning before enters. So what we want to do is to find a concrete realization of the CFT. Particularly, we want to show that our Kakumudi charges are related to Fourier modes of three massless chiral scalar fields on the circle around the puncture. And this can be achieved by modding out the D fields that move punctures around. So we will do this in two ways. Firstly, in a canonical setting by doing a gauge fixing procedure, and then later on in a covariant way by cutting the scalar field degrees of freedom in the boundary action. But let's look first at the canonical way. So away from the puncture, as I was saying, the connection is flat. So from now on, we work locally and we set the connection to zero by a gauge choice. And then the Hamiltonian action of the Kakumudi charges on the trias generates this translational gauge transformation, which is given in 1. So this is some gauge symmetry. And we want to concentrate on those transformations for which phi vanish at the boundary. And we want to define a gauge fixing by choosing a background metric on the two sphere and impose the condition 2. to remove gauge symmetry. So the equation 2 is a good gauge fixing for the degrees of freedom we want to gauge fix is explicit by looking at the Poisson bracket with the charges, which is given in equation 3, and this Poisson bracket gives us a box of phi. So this is telling us that if phi is equal to 0 on the boundary on the circle, then the only solution that satisfies annihilates the Poisson bracket is the trivial solution where phi is equal to 0 everywhere. But we don't really care about this trivial gauge transformation. So it means that the gauge transformation which we want to model out, which are the ones where phi doesn't do anything on the circle, but is different from 0 in the bulk of the two sphere. For those gauge symmetries, this G is a good gauge fixing because the Poisson bracket is different from 0 In particular, G equals zero kills the degrees of freedom which are associated to those different for which phi is different from zero in the bulk, but it's equal to zero in the on the circle, on the puncture. And these are, for instance, the diffields that move punctures around. So we mod out the diffields that move things around, and we're only left with degrees of freedom on the boundary. There is no residual diffield gauge left in the bulk. Now we want to find solutions for this gauge fixing and for the statistical constraint. So we go to slide 12. And so if we plug in the solution of the gauge fixing GI equals zero, which are given, it's the first, it's the relation between E and this field XI in equation one. So this relation here, it's a solution to the gauge fixing. And if we plug this inside the statistic constraint, we get a condition, an equation for this field XI, which is a box of XI has to be equal to zero. So now this, as you can see, this give us this allows us to express the triad variable on the boundary in terms of this auxiliary field, if you want. Now the introduction of this background metric basically amounts to a choice of a compressed structure on the boundary. Concretely, we can define complex coordinates z and z bar. And the result of introducing gauge fixing of the statistic constraint and solving these conditions require basic deparametrization of the remaining degrees of freedom on the circle in terms of holomorphic and anthropomorphic solutions of equation one, of box of xi equals zero. So we see that even though the above equation has an explicit dependence on this background metric, this will allow us to recover the form of the stress energy tensor components that will be associated to the symmetry generators later. So this will be clear when I go to the covariant picture, but this is just to tell you that we can eventually achieve background independence. We can show that the gauge fixing condition that we have here and the solution of the statistical constraint is equivalent to having a background independence later. So do not worry about this background metric for the moment. Anyway, so if we now parameterize the solution in terms of holomorphic and anthropomorphic components, we get to equation two, which tell us how these EIZ are best given by the grad Z of XI, and EIZ bar is grad Z bar of XI. And we have one more constraint to impose, which is, as I was mentioned before, that away from the puncture, sigma is equal to zero, which basically means that we have to kill either the holomorphic or the anthropomorphic degrees of freedom. Only one of them is admitted. And so also notice that due to the analytic properties of this equation box, of the solution to equation one box of x equals zero, so here so far I've been talking about just a single puncture. Of course, this can be done for all the punctures on the two spheres. And the same analyticity has to be chosen on each puncture due to the analyticity property of the solution of box of x equals zero. Otherwise, we cannot fulfill the constraint sigma equals zero. So we have, once we choose a chirality for one puncture, that has to be the same for all the punctures. So okay, now we can pull back this imperative structure to the solution of the gauge fixing and the statistic constraint, which are parameterized by this color field xi. And this is done in equation three. And you can see that we end up with a commutation relation of three boson fields xi on a flat background for each puncture. So there is a sum of a puncture of this sympathetic structure given by the sympathetic structure on boson fields. So here we see how these degrees of freedom have a real CFT nature. Okay, so if there are no questions, we can move now to the covariant picture. And before, so let's move to slide 13. Before entering into the details, let me just tell you the idea of what we want to achieve. So basically, this the presence of the distributional quantum geometry, degrees of freedom, break this invariance. And we want to restore it, and the way to do this is to introduce new degrees of freedom. So this is a situation which is similar to other cases. For instance, if we have an spin network with an open link, this breaks gauge invariance, and a way to restore it would be to add an additional degrees of freedom, which could be, for instance, a particle. Similarly, also in the case of isolated horizon, when again we have a similar situation, we have a two sphere with punctures around the two sphere. Without boundary in the quantum isolated horizon, without boundary degrees of freedom, we would violate gauge invariance. What we do is we introduce chesterton degrees of freedom to restore gauge invariance. So what we're going to do here is something similar. We're going to introduce new degrees of freedom to restore this invariance. So to see how this works, let's move to slide 14. Here, we saw before that the boundary symplectic structure and the constraint are derived from equation 1. Now, if we introduce a puncture, I'm going to concentrate on a single puncture from here for simplicity, and then we cut off an infinitesimal circle that I call CP around the puncture on the two sphere. Now our boundary basically becomes S2 minus the disk across R. And this is our new boundary. And now we can look, we can see, and I'm going to call T the word tube of the puncture, which is given by CP across R. So this is the word tube. The puncture is our boundary now. And we see that now there is, in presence of this word tube, there might be, there is a problem with the differentiability of the action that I was at the beginning. In particular, we can see that there is one term which appears when we vary the action, which is this term below equation 1, defined on the tube. Now, in order for S to be differentiable, we will need best the condition that delta E on the tube is equal to 0. This is a very strong restriction which you want to avoid. So there's an alternative to have a well-defined action principle, which is to add degrees of freedom on the tube. And we do this, so to make the action differentiable, we can do this by introducing a background metric, again, because it's quite hard. You can see easily that there is no background dependent boundary terms on T, which would restore differentiability. So we introduce this background metric for the moment, and we write these extra two terms in the action in equation 2. So there is a term which is basically the action for the free masses boson field on the circle, and then there is a coupling term between these xi's and the geometric degrees of freedom e's, which is the last term in the action. Now this pi is a tensor which is a combination of the background metric and the Levi-Civita tensor, where alpha and beta a priori are arbitrary parameters, but it's easy to see that only with the choice alpha equal plus or minus beta, we can recover the standard phase space structure of the bosonic field with C equal 3. In fact, this is the only choice for which the conserved symplectic potential on the circle reads like in equation 3, which is the symplectic potential for a free boson scalar field. So this is the action that we want to study, and we can move to slide 15. So again, now we introduce Euclidean time and this complex variable z and z bar, where theta again is the angle that goes around the circle. And if the variation of the action with respect to E give us the first equation of motion, equation 1, which again is the same equation that we saw before in the gauge fixing, is this relation between E and grad of x, which written in terms of this complex variable, it's on the right side of equation 1, is Eiz equal basically the grad z of xi. Notice that with this choice, so I was saying before, this ambiguity alpha can be plus or minus beta, so we choose the plus sign, and what the consequence of that is that we couple only the holomorphic modes. So we cannot couple both if we want to recover the synthetic potential of a scalar field, a boson scalar field. So these are the equation of motion, and then basically these tell us that if we plug in this implicit constraint, we get the equation 2, which is again box of xi equals 0, which tell us basically that the degrees of freedom we're adding are parameterized in terms of holomorphic and anthropomorphic degrees of freedom again. So now the stress energy tensor can be obtained from the variation of the action with respect to this background metric. The result is the trace free part. What you obtain is traceless due to the conformal invariance, and it's conserved, and is this equation 3, this CAB. So this CAB is traceless and then conserved. And we see that now we still have the free parameter in the action, which is this alpha. And with the choice given in equation 4, we can write this CAB such that basically only the anthropomorphic modes contribute to the stress energy tensor. Now, as I was saying before, we want to restore the different variants of the worksheet. And to do so, we need to impose that the two components left of the stress energy tensor, they have to vanish. As I was saying, it's easy to see that these two components, which are C00 and C01, they are both proportional only to the anthropomorphic degrees of freedom, which are grad z bar of xi. So imposing that again, that this restoration of worksheet different variance, namely that the stress energy tensor that we obtain from the action, has to, all the components have to vanish, implies that we need to kill half of the modes, as written in equation 5. So again, we end up with a chiral CFT, where we only have the half of the Kakumoli charges QIN. And another way to see that we have restored this invariance can be done, done in slide 15 by basically the canonical level, where we can check explicitly that spatial diffeomorphisms are restored by showing that they correspond to the general direction of the presympathetic structure. And we can verify this basically when the equation 5 in the previous slide, that is that the grad z bar of xi has to be equal to 0, is satisfied. So we look at the sympathetic form that we have now, including also the bosonic degrees of freedom, and we look at variation or the fields under tangent D fields, and ask basically for we look for the Metonian generator of these D fields by looking at null directions of the sympathetic form. And it's immediate to see this, if we plug in this variation for the field, we get to equation 2, which is a total variation, from which we can read immediately the generators of D field, which are given equation 3. And now, if we plug in the equation of motion that we found before relating the E to this bosonic degrees of freedom, we see that these are 0. So we've shown that the these charges are equal to 0. So this is a check that this invariant has been restored. Okay. So if there are no questions, we can move on to slide 17, where I will briefly review some basic aspects of the CFT Hilbert space construction. So basically, if we have an arbitrary holomorphic primary field, psi of z, which the definition of primary is given below, it tells this transformation property under conformal transformation z that goes to f of z. And this as a weight associated with this, which is h, which is given by this exponential defining the transformation property of the field phi of z. Then we have the mode expansion, and the modes can be written as you see below. Now we can consider state, which is given by the action of this primary field on a vacuum, so an asymptotic action where z goes to zero, and we create this field, and we create this state h. And now from the operator power expansion of the stress energy tensor with this primary field phi of z, basically we can, in the operatorial version, so when we look at the commutator of the modes of the Grassoro associated to the stress energy tensor and this phi of z, we can see that the commutator of L0 with phi of 0 gives us simply, it's not written here, but this is just h of phi 0, so it's h, where h is the conformal dimension, and the commutator for where n is bigger than 0 vanish. So in particular, these commutators tell us that this state h is a negative state of the L0 mode, which with again value given by the conformal weight, and is annihilated by all the higher modes where for n positive. So that's why h is called the highest weight state, and then we can construct all the other states in the representation by acting with the negative mode, so the L minus n. And this again can be seen from the commutator of L0 with these negative modes. So basically application of these negative modes increase the conformal dimension of the state, and you can see that this is again a negative state, the one that you create is again a negative state of L0, where now the eigenvalue is h plus n. So n here, capital N, is called the level of the descendant. These excited states are called the descendants, and the n is the level of the descendant. And basically, what we're going to do soon is to count how many of these excited states we have in the conformal family, which is defined by a given highest weight state. So this is just a brief summary of some details that we're going to use now. So what we want to do in slide 18 is basically to investigate the coupling between the boundary degrees of freedom and quantum geometry in the presence of an horizon. But here, when we apply our model to a stationary black hole, we have we can use a physical notion of local energy, which is associated to a stationary local observer, to do this coupling. So you see on the space-time diagram on the left, we have a stationary observer, where epsilon is a length scale that can be interpreted as the distance of the local observer to the horizon. And this scale is in direct relation with the value of the inverse Hoyle temperature measured by this local observer. Now, so this local notion of energy is given by the area of the boundary, the local area of the boundary. But this is the way to single out this Hamiltonian or classical. So what we want to do to couple the bulk and the boundary is to coarse grain the region we are looking at. So we consider a region R with many punctures inside. And then we can, we want to look at, identify basically this notion of energy with an evolution operator, to identify this notion of energy with an evolution operator at the quantum level, we need to go to this low, sort of low energy limit, continuum limit, so it can be done in this coarse grain region R. Now, the time evolution generated by this Hamiltonian corresponds to the proper time of the quasi-local observer. Those that perceive basically the horizon in thermal equilibrium at inverse temperature given by 2 pi epsilon. Now, on the other hand, the CFT Hamiltonian, which is associated to a single puncture, is given by the L0 mode of the Virasoro algebra minus a constant which depends on the central charge. And there is also a length scale, which I indicate here by epsilon prime, which is basically the radius of the circle around the puncture. So Now, if we have a coarse-grained region with many punctures, then CFT Hamiltonian is given by the sum of all these punctures of this single puncture Hamiltonian, which is written in equation 2. So equation 2, the left-hand side is the CFT Hamiltonian, and now we want to couple this to this local notion of energy coming from given by the area of the region we are considering. And notice that, so since we want to analyze the situation of thermal equilibrium, this the cylinder where the Lorentz safety loop gets compactified in the Euclidean and becomes a torus. And so the two periods of the torus are now given by these two length scale epsilon and epsilon prime, and they are related to the modular parameter of the torus according to equation 1. So this is a tau which will enter in the partition function of the CFT. Now, this constraint, too, can be seen as part of an Hamiltonian constraint of the model, and somehow imposes the synchronization of the time of the scalar field with the time measured by the stationary local observer. So this is the way somehow how one can see this cutting between bulk and bundle. And as I was saying before, the eigenstates of the CFT Hamiltonian are labeled by a string of integers, one for each puncture inside the region R, which has to say with the level of the descendant that we have at each puncture in this region. And these states define a representation of the Virchow algebra with the central charge, which is now 3, the one coming from each puncture, times the number of punctures. So we have this big central charge at 3 times the number of punctures. So with this, now the equation 2 becomes, if we go to next slide, can be written as an equation 1, where I called capital delta the eigenvalues of L0 associated to the coarse-grained region R. So it's a sum of all the punctures of all the eigenvalues of L0 for single punctures. And equation 1 gives the is again this relation between the CFT quantum number and the LQG quantum numbers entering inside of the expectation, the eigenvalue of the operator on the right-hand side. Now we want to look at the asymptotic density of states and the CFT partition function. Let me point out a key observation that, so the number of states for n functions satisfy the constraint where the sum of all the eigenvalues delta A, delta 1, L delta P is equal to a given delta. So basically, where this capital delta is the sum of all the eigenvalues for single puncture, and where each puncture has a central charge equal 3 is the same as the number of states of a single CFT, given where we take the central charge to be the sum of all the central charges and the L0 eigenvalue to be the sum of all the L0 eigenvalues for a single puncture. So the counting basically corresponds to the counting for a single CFT, which have this effective central charge and this effective eigenvalue of the L0 mode. And then this is given by the Cardy formula, which is written in equation 2. notice that the number of states which are compatible with the macroscopic area will be dominated by configuration with the maximum number of punctures. And these are the configurations where all the spins coming from the bulk are 1/2. And so it's easy to see the other configurations are subdominant. And that's why in this case, the central charge is given in equation 3, where the number of punctures is basically given by the total area divided by the 1/2 eigenvalue of area. So this is how we get the equation 3 for the central charge. And also, we notice that the partition function, when we use these constraints to couple bulk and boundary, which link the CFT with the macroscopic area of the black hole, the system has a maximal possible temperature, which usually is called the Argandon temperature, which assures the convergence of the partition function. And from this value, this can be translated in a value for this modular parameter tau, which is given in equation 4. So this is the last ingredient that we need, this expression for the modular parameter given by this condition that basically we can have microscopic black holes. So if we plug in these ingredients inside the Calvi formula, we end up with the expression for the degeneracy, which is given in equation 5, which is this holographic bound of the area of the region over 4 G Newton. So, are there any questions? Okay, then basically I can move to the summary of the talk. Slide.
Can you comment more on the fact that you fixed the modular parameter to be inverse proportional to the Minsky parameter? Like, what is the physics behind it? Geometry or some restriction on the states of the CFT, or can you say more?
So this tau is basically a ratio between two cutoffs. As maybe if you go to slide 18. This epsilon plays a UV cutoff in the sense that, you know, it's the cutoff on the proper distance of the station observer to the horizon. And epsilon prime also plays a role of cutoff, which is given by this radius of the circle. So eventually one would like to send both this cutoff to zero when in a continuum limit. So this tau is tell us how this limiting procedure should be taken. And this tau, of course, this tau basically labels possible shapes of the torus. And so basically this is telling us, this condition of tau, that this limiting procedure has to be taken such that this ratio stays constant and is given by this 1 over gamma. Now, it's not completely clear to us what are the physical implications of this condition. So, I mean, tau somehow enters, it's a parameter that controls transformation properties of the CFT partition function, like modularity of the CFT partition function. So it might be that the modularity, symmetry and the modular transformation of the CFT partition function might have a physical meaning. It might be, in fact, might be related maybe to like local Lorentz invariance. This is not clear to us yet.
Hey, can you clarify one more point?
Yeah.
In quantum gravity, we have a minimal eigenvalue for distances, also some sort of natural ultraviolet cutoff, if you want. So why do you want to send this epsilon to zero instead of, let's say, the minimal possible distance?
Yeah, you can. It's the same. You need to send both cutoffs. I mean, you want to shrink them as much as you can, of course. And you want to send both cutoff, epsilon prime, to a minimum. In fact, even epsilon prime cannot be sent to zero, in a sense. This is, you know, the radius of the circle around the puncture. So there is, in this case, epsilon prime has some sort of minimum value. So if you want, this is a limiting procedure, which you send both cutoff to this minimum length, and you should get this tau, or this ratio of 1 over gamma. So basically you send one to, it's like you send one cutoff to a Planck and the other cutoff to gamma at Planck, if you want.
A question, follow-up?
Which, by the way, might be related to the simplicity constraint, if you want, because, you know, you have that, epsilon lives in the RT space and epsilon prime lives in the theta phi space. So if you want, these are periods of rotations in these two dual planes, and the simplicity constraint, which relates the rotation the rotations in these two planes, are related by this factor gamma. So it might be that this specific value of tau might be related to the simplicity constraint in the end, but this is not.
Lina, do you have a question?
Yes, when you take tau going like 1 over the Barbero parameter, mm-hmm. you get rid of the dependence of gamma in the entropy. That's equation 5.
Yes. Yes.
So where do we see that results in the Hagedorn temperature? Which equation should we look at to see that?
It's not written here, but basically that comes from, if you replace the Cardy formula inside the CFT partition function, you get basically that the dominant contribution is given for large delta, and this is the density of space for large delta. So now you want to ask that this density of state doesn't blow up the partition function. So you want that the Boltzmann factor inside the partition function basically compensate for this degeneracy of state, and demanding that basically that the log of Z being 1 correspond to choosing this value of tau.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, then we can move to the summary. So we presented a possibilization of this idea that somehow local conformal symmetry can play a fundamental role, especially in unifying a description of gravity and metal degrees of freedom at the Planck scale, by showing how two-dimensional conformal degrees of freedom arise naturally in the presence of function on the boundary from the gravitational symplectic structure. And these new degrees of freedom introduced by conformal symmetry, they introduce a new degeneracy of microstates. These somehow are degenerate degrees of freedom of geometry, which provide a possibility to remove exactly what I was mentioned before, this log Z contribution to the entropy, which gives this holographic bound without fine-tuning the Barberi-Mitzi parameter to a specific value. Now, there are many open issues that we would like to understand better, and some of them are listed in slide 21. So the nice feature of this construction there is a huge potential to apply now this very well-studied mathematics, which is 2D CFT, in the context of loop quantum gravity, where somehow these degrees of freedom arise naturally. And some questions are, for instance, is this color coupling between geometry and these new degrees of freedom a fundamental aspect? And if it's so, does it have any phenomenological implication? Also, the Lorentz group is a subgroup, this is something I was also somehow mentioned before, the Lorentz group is a subgroup of this conformal transformation. Now, is there any relationship between this Lorentz group coming from the conformal group and the space-time one? In particular, is there a hope that by understanding better the coupling between the boundary Hilbert space and the LQG Hilbert space, we can have an explicit representation of local Lorentz invariants? And another interesting question to look at is, can we use these new degrees of freedom at the boundary to study Hawking radiation and maybe be able to say something about the information paradox? Also, can we define new CFT observables in quantum gravity using this huge machinery that we have now at our disposal? And finally, can we describe, this is also what I was asking at the beginning, can we describe back geometry from this boundary CFT correlations and somehow recover an effective semiclassical dynamics from, for instance, entanglement properties that we have on the boundary the CFT? So these are all questions that we would like to address and understand better, but there is a huge potential now to apply these techniques that have been studied for more than 20 years in mathematics. So thank you for your attention.
Questions?
This is Carlo. I have a question.
Yeah.
I find this extremely interesting, and I like all the technical part of it. I just want to express an opinion that I think that what is not yet clear, is missing, is the physical interpretation of these boundary degrees of freedom. I think it's there's a big discussion here to be done, which I have not heard yet. Space-time is space-time in some sense. I take a region, I take a boundary. In which sense, if there is a boundary, then you use a freedom before the technical analysis. I have some ideas about that. That's one of the reasons I'm saying that. I think that somehow the boundary degree of freedom have been floating around the literature in some ghosty ways, and unless there is clarity about what they are, I feel uncomfortable. Yeah, I just wanted to express it.
What do you
think about that? That's the question.
No, I mean, I agree that it's not clear yet what the physical nature of these degrees of freedom are. We find this representation in terms of free matter scalar fields, but of course, before being able to call these degrees of freedom as matter, one has to understand them much better. So this is just one intriguing possibility that this matter might arise from broken different of freedom degrees of freedom as some degenerate degrees of freedom of geometry, for instance. But I agree with you that at this stage it's not clear if that's really the case. And besides, I mean, this is on the boundary, and we need to understand better how the coupling with the bulk works and understand better how we can probably talk about these degrees of freedom in terms of matter. So I agree with you that there is a lot of work to be done to understand this.
Can I try a stab at this issue? Because it's very beautiful, it's extremely beautiful what you've done, but I think you'd agree. The idea of blowing up a puncture in a boundary degree of freedom and finding a Katz-Moody algebra which could be represented by the degrees of freedom of a Wessonian-Witten theory isn't new. It goes back to Moore and Seiberg and to mathematicians before that.
Absolutely.
To my understanding, the basic physics is a necessity to frame the edges of the spin networks in the neighborhood of the boundary because of the dominance of the Chern-Simon action. And that it's really, it avoids an anomaly which would otherwise be there in the algebra of loop operators because of the dominance of the Chern-Simon factor at the boundary. And it's been there really all along from the 90s, and as you say, the mathematics has been there for even longer, and it's just a matter of putting the pieces together, which you're starting to do very beautifully.
More questions?
If there is no other question, this is Carlo again. I might add some comments. I think that engage theory, in general, we have this view of gauge theories, which gauge is the numbers. Then we put a boundary, and somehow we wonder that there's new funny degrees of freedom, and get confused. I think that there is some physics to be clarified here, and the physics to be clarified, the gauge degrees of freedom in a gauge theory are not just mathematical redundancies; they are exactly the quantities that allow the gauge theory to be coupled with something external. So when we use a gauge theory with a boundary, gauge degrees of freedom in the absence of the boundary are exactly the ways from the outside we can couple to the gauge theory. I have a few papers on that. I had a long discussion with Lohan when I was in perimeters last time, and he seemed to agree with this interpretation of the boundary degrees of freedom. Have you discussed this with you, or is that?
Yeah. No. But this is exactly the idea. I mean, for instance.
Why
is it disappeared somehow? Yeah,
so can I come
up?
In fact,
I wanted
to.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
So, X16, what we show is that the charges once boundary degrees of freedom, I mean, this new axis, that's zero. So you have to restore this invariant. But of course,
hello?
That doesn't mean that you don't have physical degrees of freedom anymore. These are exactly the, except what you say, the way to couple the bulk with the boundary, in present boundary, the physical nature to these charges that are now not engaged anymore. So it's exactly this idea that you mentioned.
Okay.
We discussed this a lot with Laurent, absolutely.
Hello?
We can hear you.
Anybody?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello? Are we still there?
Yeah, I want to comment on doubles and transition points. I mean, essentially, it is exactly where
the...
Is Laurent in the background?
I think Laurent is trying to ask a question to Elvio.
On the ground, for a gauged world, are trying to... merge to reality.
Laurent, we can't hear you very well.
We can't hear you at all. We just get some noise.
Recording voice was like...
Are we
on the new system or
also? Okay, so are we on the new system? I mean, having called, so I just here. Thanks to Steve Rogan.